We generally keep the world's news separate from Golf Smarter, but I have to ask for a moment of hope for everyone affected worldwide by the devastation in Japan. As one Golf Smarter listener responded when I asked if he knew anyone directly impacted, he said, "No, I don't, but I feel like I do." For members only, Golf Smarter number 274, published on March 15th, 2011.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
NATO Golf, not attached to outcome, with Mel Soul.
This is Golf Smarter. Sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome to Golf Smarter for members only, Mel.
Thank you very much, Fred. I'm happy to be here.
You know, I was looking over your bio and I noticed that you had the opportunity to play on the South African PGA Tour for almost a decade. Or was that just over a decade?
Yeah, just from 69 to 79, so about a decade, yeah.
Is golf radically different today than it was during the 70s?
For the professional golfer, definitely. For the amateur, no, about the same. I think amateurs, you know, that have jobs and only play recreationally, I think that's pretty much stayed the same over the years. Of course, the equipment has changed dramatically, but golfers, I think, still play once or twice a week and still have a great time.
Why is it different for the that's so interesting. You know, the PGA is like, we will never make rules that separate, you know, the pros from the amateurs. Well, everybody has to play the same rules, and yet they come out with these rules about the wedges that, yeah, well, you know, for the amateurs, it's going to happen in 15 years, but for the pros, they have to do it now. So they've already contradicted themselves. And yeah. Here you say that that golf today is different for the players on tour than it is for the amateur player. Explain that for me.
Well, I think it's become much more of a business. I mean, when I was on tour, you know, it was a lot of camaraderie after the round. We went out to dinner together. You know, we were traveling in a group. And I think back in the 50s on the US PGA Tour, it was similar. Now it's such a business that when the guys walk off the golf course, they've got their managers and their coaches and their sports psychologists. And
let's not forget their sponsors.
As sponsors.
Licking the bottom of their shoes.
Yeah. And, you know, it's they leave the golf course and they get in their planes or helicopters and boom, they're gone. And they show up again the next morning. And there's, you know, it's one of the things that has been discussed in why the Europeans beat us, you know, so often in the Ryder Cup. And it's that camaraderie, I think, in Europe that still exists, that in America, golf has become such a business, and they have, you know, sponsors and that they have to appear with, and they have their little workout routines. And, I mean, I heard that Tiger never really goes out to a restaurant. He has his own personal chef and, you know, eats at home all the time.
So, well, he probably does now. He's not seen out at many of the local dives anymore,
yeah,
probably.
Yeah. But, yeah, that's what I mean by it being significantly different that way.
That's a very interesting point. And you think in other tours around the world, as the South African, the European, the Asian tour, they do, I guess the money is not... The rewards are not as great as they are in other places in the world, and these guys are still struggling to make a living.
It's getting there. I mean, the European Tour has definitely now become, over the last decade, extremely strong. And I think the Ryder Cup is partly to blame for that, I think. Or you know, is we now with it's become such a great event that the Europeans, I mean, if you'd 10 or 15 years ago, if you'd said, well, who's Lee Westwood or who's Colin Montgomery, most of the Americans wouldn't even have known. But now we all know them because now they play, you know, sometimes on our tour. And So because their name recognition is now greater, sponsors are therefore are more interested in them, and their tour has grown greater and greater. And the Asian tour might not have caught up yet, but it's on its way as well.
I apologize for not having a depth of knowledge of the South African PGA Tour in the 70s, but were there players that you competed against that were able to make the transition to the U.S. PGA Tour and had success?
Oh, absolutely.
I have a feeling I know who you're going to say.
Yeah, I mean, the guy that I grew up idolizing, Gary Player.
Right.
We were just talking the other night when Tiger was playing overseas, and I said, you know, Gary Player always supported the South African tour. And when our tour was on, which was usually from January to March, Gary was there, and Gary played in all the tournaments. And he could have made a lot more money playing in the U.S., but he felt it was his obligation as a world-class player to play, because then the sponsors would put more money in and the crowds would come. And I always admire him for doing that. And the players today, I think, you know, if they get a $3 million appearance fee like Tiger got last week, then they, you know, skip the U.S. event and go off. And I think sometimes I think that's wrong.
So when you mentioned last week, you're talking about, because this may be published weeks later, and some people may not hear this for a couple months, but you're talking about when Tiger played in Dubai?
Right.
And so, it wasn't simultaneously. They were playing at Pebble Beach.
They were playing at Pebble Beach. And
it's kind of strange not to see Tiger playing Pebble Beach.
Exactly. You know, so his deal with Dubai is now over. He had, I think, a 3-year deal with. So, you know, I don't know what he's going to do next year, but I'd be disappointed if he didn't play in the tournament at Pebble Beach. You know, I even get disappointed when I hear that some pros don't play in Pebble Beach because it's a pro-am and they don't want to play with the amateur golfers. And, you know, this is why we're here. This is why the tour exists, is because of the amateur golfers. I mean, our tour wouldn't exist if we didn't have the amateurs to come and support us and come and watch and, you know.
Yeah, we had a conversation with Andrew McGee last year, and he said that it really is the obligation of the tour players to participate in these events to help promote the sport and to bring more people out to in attendance.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And I think that they're trying to make a rule. I don't know how far they're going to get with it, but they're trying to make a rule where the players are going to be obligated to play in the lesser events every third year or something, you know. So if they, you know, somebody like Tiger Woods would have to play in some of the smaller events at least once every 3 years to give it a bit of a boost and keep it going. And I would be all for that.
Mm. So did you get a chance to play with Gary Player against
yes,
him
I did.
On the tour?
Yes. We had the same coach, Phil Ritson, who is my partner in the golf school.
Right.
You know, he was Gary Player's coach, and he was my coach. And so I got very often to play practice rounds with Gary. And, you know, he was always very, very good to me. I mean, I was just another struggling young kid on the tour. But and Gary at that stage was, you know, Palmer, Player, and Nicklaus were the big three. And I was always grateful that he treated me so well, and I always felt, you know, honored to be in his presence.
Mm. And was he a mentor as well, or was he just more like an inspiration? Did he take you under his wing?
Yeah, he was a mentor in a way that I think he doesn't even realize.
That's nice.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't really a mentor to me in terms of my swing or anything like that, but I learned so much from him on how to be a gentleman, how to behave on the golf course, how to dress, you know, smartly. And to this day, I mean, as I'm sitting here now, my top button of my golf shirt is done up, and I've done that all my life. And I do that because on the golf course, Gary Player always had their top button done up. And my dad used to say to me, look at him, look how smart he looks, you know. Look at these other guys with their shirt hanging out and their collars all over the place. And, you know, and that kind of made an impression with me. And to this day, I still do it. And I've never ever told Gary, but, you know, there's little things that I do today that I still think, yeah, well, Gary would be proud of that, you know.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, actually, I'm watching you. We are doing a video Skype conversation, and I did notice that your top button was buttoned. I was like, wow, he got dressed up for this one, but he's still in his, you know, he's still in his den here. And yeah. I'm pretty sure, if I'm not mistaken, I'm looking over your left shoulder. Do I see Cape Town behind you?
Yes, that is a picture of Cape Town. This is actually, I'm in my viewing room at the golf school.
Okay.
Yeah, that is a picture of Cape Town. When I left South Africa in 1989, that I went to a store and bought that, and I thought, wherever I go, I'm going to take that with me.
Is that where you're from?
That's still home to me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I still miss it, but this is the place where I want to be.
Someday I'll get there.
Yeah, yeah.
I would love
Cape Town is definitely one of the most beautiful cities in the world.
Mm. Well, I like ours here in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Anyway, did you have any success on the tour in South Africa?
No, not really. I think my best finish in a tournament was third. I think it was called the Cape Open way back in the 70s. Gary Player won that tournament by like 17 shots.
Wow.
And then there was a young kid who played on the U.S. tour by the name of Bobby Cole, who was second. And then I was kind of a distant third. But I most probably made as many cuts as I missed. And, you know, finally after 10 years, decided to pack in the tournament stuff and, you know, become a club pro at that point.
Fabulous. Well, I want to get to how we got together. There was a conversation going on in LinkedIn, and somebody had posted a question saying, if you could give one tip for 2011 on how to improve your game, what would it be? And it's actually been very entertaining to follow that conversation because there have been hundreds of suggestions. Mm-hmm. And somebody even wrote, my God, people, there's hundreds of suggestions, and all we did was ask for one tip. This is the problem with golf. There's just too much to think about. But yours, go ahead, I'm sorry.
It is true. I mean, we've all got our own ideas of what the best tip is. So when somebody says one tip, yes, it's one tip, but it'll be from hundreds of people, and the tip will be different each time.
Yeah, it's like... you know, have you ever heard about the barbershop quartet filled with golfers? It's called the Five Opinions.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, your tip jumped off the page to me. I thought it was very interesting. Why don't you explain what it is?
Well, what I had said was, you know, learn to play NATO golf. And
could be explosive.
Yeah.
NATO, and it was capital NATO, so it made me think, what, this guy is just going to come in with fighter jets and explode the whole place. What are you talking about?
Well, I was reading a book called Final Rounds, and it's a story about a father and a son who the son finds out that his father is dying of cancer, and he wants to take his father to Scotland, and it's a true story, and if you really like golf and you like reading, it's a great read. And so while they're playing over in Scotland, the author, whose name doesn't come to me right now, but he loses his temper and he throws his club and he gets mad, and his father says to him, son, he said, you should learn to play NATO golf. And his son looks at him and says, well, what is that? And he said, not attached to outcome.
Wow.
And that just jumped right off the page at me, and I went, wow, I said, that I'm going to use that all the time, because that's what we all do. You know, before we play the shot, you know, we're always either in the past or in the future. You know, we're like, oh, the last time I played this shot, I hooked it, you know, so I'm going to try not to hook it this time. Or you go into the future and you look and say, oh, if I slice this ball, I could go out of bounds. And so when you get to the space about not attached to outcome, I'm just going to make a golf swing and, you know, whatever happens, happens. And when you can get into that space in your mind, golf becomes a whole lot easier.
You stumped me here. Golf easy? Come on.
I didn't say easy. I said easier.
Okay.
There's a big difference.
There's a very big difference. While you were speaking, I went on to Amazon.com and I found Final Rounds, A Father, A Son, The Golf Journey of a Lifetime. And it was written by James Dodson. And I will make sure that this book is put on our Golfers Mart at golfsmarter.com. We have a book page that you can purchase Amazon books right there from the Golfers Mart at golfsmarter.com, and I'll make sure that it's there. And I'm not sure if there's a Kindle version or not, and if there is, we'll make sure that that book is available there as well. So again, it's called Final Rounds, A Father, A Son, The Golf Journey of a Lifetime by James Dodson. And you can buy it used for less than $10.
Yeah, that's good.
But it is a phenomenal comment, not attached to outcome, because so many times we hear from mental coaches who say it's about the process, not about the outcome. Stay with the process. And it seems like so many golfers forget about that. They lose it, and they beat themselves up for the outcome, or they're too attached to the scorecard.
I think what the sports psychologists are meaning is that if you stay within the process, then you don't worry about the outcome. I mean, if the process is correct, then the outcome is a given. So in a way, I can understand what they're saying is, if you stay in the process, you're not going to worry about the outcome. And it's a fine line, but that's where I try and teach most of my students when they come through the school. We have a thing that we teach them called a clear key. And the clear key is...
Carrie Mumford. Who was on the show a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, really?
Oh, Carrie's an old friend of Golf Smarter. He's been on numerous times.
Yeah. Well, I learned a lot from Carrie, and Clear Key was one of the things I learned from Carrie. And that was in 1989 that I met Carrie, 1989, 1990. And I still use the Clear Key to this day. I believe in it very strongly, and I teach all my students that.
Thank you, because a couple of weeks ago, we had our Golf Smarter adventure. A number of listeners and myself got together to play golf for 4 days in Scottsdale, Arizona. And it was just a week or so after the Carrie Mumford show was on. And Carrie and I went on for, as you know, Carrie, we went on for almost an hour.
Yeah.
And I was kind of raked over the coals by some of the listeners because Carrie was all over the place. Carrie, it was hard to keep Carrie in one train of thought. He kept moving all over the place. But I did try to reassure them that he does have valuable messages and he really is quite knowledgeable about what he's talking about. We're just not sure what it is. I think he's just in a different planet than the rest of us sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, when Carrie used to come into town here, I used to, you know, take him out to dinner because I wanted to just, you know, soak in as much of his knowledge as I could. And we'd go back to his hotel room and we'd sit talking until, you know, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning.
I mean, there you go.
Coming up, you know, and Carrie can do that to you.
Yes, thank you for that affirmation. I truly appreciate it. I feel so much better. So there, Lou. And at your golf school, and I'd like to transition over to that because now that we understand not attached to outcome, you clearly do more than just teach swing mechanics at your school, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, you want to, if you want to become a better golfer, you've got to combine the physical aspects and the mental aspects together. You know, I'm one of those that believes that it's a 50-50 process. That you want to have 50% of your game working on your swing and 50%. And if you can get the two about equal, that's when you'll, you know, I sometimes read from sports psychologists or, you know, well, golf is 90% mental. Well, you know, if you believe, then you can do it. Well, all you've got to do is watch a show like American Idol, and you watch those people go up on the stage, and they believe that they are the best singers in the world. They believe that they are, and they stand up on the stage and they sound terrible. And when the judges say, sorry, you know, you can't make it, they are devastated. So they had the belief, but they didn't have the talent. Then you have the others that go up there and they're very nervous and they've got the talent, but they don't have the personality. And the judges go, well, you know, you've got the voice, but you need to work on it. And so you've got, that's a typical example. American Idol is a typical example of the average golfer. Is some of the golfers believe that they're great golfers, but they've got no talent. And then there's the others that have got talent that just have no confidence. And so you have to end up getting a little bit of both. And that's where I focus my golf school, is I teach the students the swing mechanics and I teach them the mental side. And that way, hopefully, we build a foundation that when they go on the golf course, they can, you know, attack the golf course in a solid, fundamental way.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
In over almost 300 episodes of the Golf Smarter podcast, you, my friend, are the very first person to make reference to American Idol. And you've outed me. I'm totally hooked on that show. It is amazing how invested we become in these kids' personalities and start rooting for them. But you're absolutely right. Some of them, there's the arrogance about them, and you just want them to lose, and you just see how they can't fit in. And then there's the ones who have this quiet confidence about them that just go about their business, but yet believe they are, they believe in themselves. Whether they believe they're the greatest singer that ever lived or not, it's not relevant. It's whether they believe in themselves. And it is sometimes devastating to watch them be crushed by the fact that they've been told, not this week. And it's not always because you're not the best one out there. It's just that there's somebody better. And I think your analogy to golf is amazing. It's, you have to stay in your own game. And you're never, one of my favorite lines about golf is that you're competing against yourself and you can never win.
And that's correct.
Yeah, I mean, and then with the same thing.
That's why, you know, we as golfers enjoy this game so much, is because when we walk onto the first tee each and every round, we have no idea what to expect. You know, it could be our best round of golf ever, and we're going to shoot, or it could be a horrible round that we're going to be devastated with, you know. And that's the fascination with golf, you know. And even though you might go and practice and work hard, and when you go to the first tee, boy, and you put the tee in the ground, it's a whole new experience each time.
And even if you're on track to do your best round ever after nine holes and you realize it, that could be the kiss of death right there.
I mean, how many times have you know, everybody that's listening to this podcast can relate to this. I mean, you know, play the front nine in your lowest score ever and you go to the back nine and everything goes to pieces, or vice versa. You play your front nine and you just can't do anything right, and you go to the back nine and mentally you go, oh, well, you know, it's going to be a bad day, and you kind of relax a little bit. And then on the back nine, everything starts clicking. Mm-hmm. And when you walk off the 18th green, you're like, boy, let's go and do this again, you know? After nine holes, you're like, I'm going to never play this game again. And after 18, you're like, let's do another 18.
Exactly. But you're right. I know personally and have witnessed it many times where people play a great front nine and they start saying, all I have to do to shoot my best score ever is shoot A. And they start talking about the score over nine holes. And I'm sorry, it just doesn't work that way. Not in this sport. I mean, you can have a range of 10 strokes from one round to the next easily.
And that's where Carrie Mumford's Clear Key really comes in, is it keeps you in the present and, you know, doesn't allow you to go into the future or the past. And so then you have a better chance. If you just play, you know, it's an old cliche, but one shot at a time is most probably, if you're having a good round, that's the key, is just play each shot to the best of your ability and not worry. Go back to NATO, absolutely.
Yep, not attached to outcome. Well, you know, I'd be raked again over the coals if I didn't take this opportunity to have somebody else's interpretation. Can you explain to us Clear Key in a concise manner so we understand what it is and how to utilize it in our game?
Well, I'll give you a really good example. If you're playing baseball or you're playing basketball or you're playing football, when you, let's say you're a quarterback in football and you get the snap, you don't stand there thinking, oh, well, now hang on a minute, that guy's running over there, and maybe if I get my arm back far enough, I've got to keep my hips square. And I mean, by that time, he's on the ground. And the basketball player, when he gets, Michael Jordan gets the ball, he's not thinking about, you know, well, my foot is here and my elbow's got to be here. It's all instinct. Now, all of those other sports are what I call instinct sports. You're reacting to a ball or a player. In golf, the ball is stationary. So you have all this time to think. The golf swing takes between 1 to 1.5 seconds, and the brain can process a lot of information in 1.5 seconds, as we've all experienced. And so what the Clear Key does is it quiets the mind. It clears, as Kerry Mumford used to say, it clears the hacking in the head. And so, you know, it's like a mantra, you know. My Clear Key is Geronimo. And I say the word Geronimo 3 times as I'm swinging. So it's Geronimo, Geronimo, Geronimo. So my impact is on the Ron of the third Geronimo. Now, if I'm saying my Geronimos at the same pace each swing, and my impact is happening on the same syllable, that means that A, my pace of my golf swing is exactly the same every single time, whether I've got a driver in my hand or a pitching wedge in my hand. The pace of my swing is the same on the first hole, the ninth hole, the 16th hole, the 18th hole, today, tomorrow, next week, next month, next year. And if I'm saying this little mantra while I'm swinging, I'm blocking my conscious mind. I'm blocking my conscious mind from thinking, cock my wrist, shift my weight, turn my hands. So the Clear Key is like a two-edged sword. It gives us the rhythm, and it gives us clear, quiet mind. And that is the real secret to Kerry Mumford's Clear Key.
It's a beautiful explanation. Thank you. But I do have some questions about it.
Sure.
When do you start your first Geronimo?
As I start the club back. So I go through my pre-shot routine. I usually stand behind the ball and look down the fairway and kind of visualize the shot I want. Then I do a practice swing that emulates the shot that I'm going to hit, whether I'm going to hit a draw or a fade or a straight shot, whatever I want. And then I walk into the ball, put my club behind the ball, set my body square to my club face, and then as I start my backswing, I start with the Geronimo, Geronimo, Geronimo. So my two Geronimos, the first two is my backswing. So I go Geronimo, Geronimo. That takes me to the top of my backswing. And then it's Geron to impact, and Emo as I go through. And so with that, two Geronimos going back and basically a half a Geronimo down to impact is a 4-to-1 ratio speed. Now, I found this out a number of years ago talking to Jim Uckenbach from Golf Week magazine, and he, when I was talking about the Clear Key to him, and he said, well, that's interesting because most of the top players in the world have a 4-to-1 backswing to downswing ratio. And I didn't even know that. And I was like, wow, you know, that I just did that by accident. But that in fact has now helped me have a pretty good rhythm in my golf swing.
Do you find that sometimes when you get caught in your Geronimo, 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 all of a sudden, because you've said it so many times for every round, that your other things start creeping into your head while you're saying it? I know that I've been caught with that, with my clear key, and I'll give you an explanation of mine in a second.
I would say now, no. I would say in the beginning, when I was first trying to teach myself the clear key, and it's a learned skill. It's not something that, you know, oh, you do the clear key, poop, and there you got it. It's like learning the golf swing. You have to train your mind to let go. So it took me, I would say it took me 6 months to really, and I still remember the very first shot I ever hit. It was at the 16th hole at the Legends Golf Course in Myrtle Beach, the Heathland course. And I hit a 2-iron and I went into my clear key and I hit it. And when that ball came off the club face, I was like, wow, that's it. That I did not think mechanics at all. My mind was just right here in the moment. And after that, it started to become easier to get into the clear key.
Were you with Kerry at the time?
No, I wasn't. But I did email him and tell him because it was that one shot that kind of validated that the clear key was not just some hocus-pocus type of thing, but it was something that was very valuable in the golf swing.
I actually remember, strangely enough, I actually remember the first time I used a clear key was with Kerry at the Bird Golf Academy in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And the first shot that I had was almost exactly the same reaction you had was, wow, that was amazing. The result of that, you know, the outcome of the shot without thinking about it was amazing. You're absolutely correct.
Right.
And so my clear key, at least the way I remember Kerry working with me and the way I've been doing it now for a couple of years, is I will say to myself, he gets this nonsensical thing going on, as Mary had a little lamb, I wish I had one too. Mm-hmm. And it's a rhythm. But the way I understood it and the way I was working it was, after I get behind the ball, I visualize my target. I visualize the swing. Then I get myself everything in order. And then at the moment that I say, okay, I'm about to step up to the ball and clear my mind, I'll start my clear key right before that first step.
Okay.
So I'm walking up to the ball with, so I have a very clear rhythm. I don't stand over the ball a long time. I don't do, you know, I just walk up to the ball and take my swing. So it's... I start my walk, Mary had a little lamb, I wish I had one too. I'm at the ball, Mary had a little lamb, I wish I had one too. And then I start my third and my backswing and follow through with that.
Okay. Yeah, and I mean, everybody
doing it?
Obviously, no, I think, you know, when I have students and I'm trying to, you know, teach them the clear key, and I said, you know, this is my clear key, but that's not necessary, you know, what's going to be right for you. You have to experiment and find out what is the best way for you. I'm trying to think. There was a player that I spoke to from the PGA Tour, and I think it might have been Fulton Alum. I'm not 100% sure on this, but where he also started the clear key from back behind the ball, and then walked into the ball with his using the clear key and then hit it. I would say my from the time I start walking into the ball to the time I start my backswing is about the same time each time. I'm a fairly fast player, so I kind of don't dilly-daddle or have a lot of waggles or anything. I put the club behind the ball and I go into my clear key straight away. So, but you've got to experiment and see what works for you.
Absolutely. Let's talk about your school. I understand that Phil Ritson, your partner in the names of your school, the Phil Ritson Mel Soul golf schools was your teacher as a young man.
Yes.
And he's still teaching?
Phil doesn't teach very much anymore. Phil is down in Orlando. I know that he still teaches, but not at the amount that he used to teach. I know he works with some of the Korean girls, and but Phil is now, I imagine, 80. In fact, I think his birthday was January 31. It's just gone by, and I think he was maybe 82 or 83.
So, same age as Carrie Mumford.
Know, yeah, and Phil just recently has not been well. And so maybe he's cut down on his teaching. I did not. I wanted to go and see him when I was down at the PGA show. I wanted to go and see him, but my schedule and my time didn't allow it, and so I didn't get to see him this time. But usually when I go down to Orlando, I try and at least pop in and say hi.
Well, we wish him well.
Yeah.
And hope that he does well. Tell me about your school.
Well, we've been here in the Myrtle Beach area since we just celebrated our 20th anniversary, December 31. And so we've been here. And then over the years, we've opened other locations, starting actually in Kansas City. We opened in a school there in 93. And then slowly over the years, I now have one in Atlanta, one at Ellicottville, New York, Greenville, South Carolina. Last year, I had one at Cougar Canyon, which is in Trinidad, Colorado. I'm not sure whether I'm going to have it there this year. We'll see. But yeah, we've sort of built our reputation slowly and over the years. And back in 1999, Golf Magazine started to come out with the top 25 golf schools. And we were fortunate enough to be on that list. And we have been on that list ever since.
Wow.
And we are only one of six academies that have remained on that list the whole time. And we are now ranked number 5 in the nation. So, you know, we've worked hard, but I think the formula that we have has worked well. And obviously, you know, Golf Magazine bases their results on input from the students. And the students here have obviously enjoyed their experience and enjoyed learning. And obviously, the golf has improved. And that is what we're here for.
Well, congratulations on that high ranking. That's phenomenal. And for being so consistently ranked that way, how can people find your golf school online if they want to get more information and sign up to play?
Well, our website is www.ritson-sole.com.
Ritson-sole.com?
Yeah, but if you just type in melsole.com, you'll find the website too. It'll redirect. If you can't remember Ritson-Sole, just type in melsole.com and you'll get to the same page. And all the locations are there. And come on down and see us. We'd love to improve your game.
Oh, that's a very kind offer. Thank you very much. I need to ask you one last question before we wrap this up. Since you've been exposed to so many great, not only teachers, but mentors, as a golfer, can you share with us the greatest piece of advice you've ever received about golf? Not as an instructor, but as a golfer.
Yes, I can. And this one actually stands out way above everything else. When I was on tour and playing, my dad always used to say to me, you know, you don't focus, you don't. And I used to stand there and think, well, what is focus? You know, what is, I don't understand what focus is. You know, I concentrate, I think, but you know, I'd constantly get this thing about I don't focus enough. And a number of years ago, I was having dinner with Nick Price, and I said to Nick the same question. I said, what was the best tip you've ever had? And he said, well, I was getting a playing lesson from Bob Rotella. He said, we got to the first tee, and I put my tee in the ground, and I was just about to hit my shot, and Bob Rotella said, stop. And he said, now, without looking up, you're standing here looking at your ball, without looking up, I want you to tell me where you aimed. And Nick said, well, I'm aimed down the fairway. And he said, okay, now come and stand behind your ball and tell me where you really would like to aim. So Nick went back behind his ball, had a look down the fairway, and he said, well, there's a bunker there on the right-hand side that I can carry, and it's a slight dogleg left, so I'll try and hit my drive over that bunker. And Bob Rotella said to him, well, which part of the bunker? And Nick looked at the bunker, and he said, well, I can see a rake laying on the top edge of the bunker there. He said, I'll go over the rake. And Bob said to him, well, which tooth on the rake? And Nick looked at him and said, you're kidding, right? And he said, no. He said, if your target is the size of your finger and you miss it by 10 yards, you still hit a good shot. But if the target is the fairway and you miss it by 10 yards, you've just hit a terrible shot. And that brought to me the understanding of what the word focus meant. Focus is narrowing your vision down to a very fine, exact point that you want that ball to go. Off a tee shot, it could be, you know, a side of the fairway. You know, you could say, all right, you know, you've got a fairway there that's maybe 30 yards wide. I'm going to hit it 5 yards from the right rough. If it's a flag stick or it's the green, you want to pick a spot on the green where you want to land the ball. It might not necessarily be at the flag if the flag's tucked, you know, behind the corner or something. But you want each shot that you play, each chip, each bunker shot, each putt, you want to narrow your focus down to a very small. If you can do that consistently, your body starts responding to that, and you start hitting better shots. And that finally made me understand what the word focus was. Unfortunately, when I had that dinner with Nick Price, I had, you know, quit playing tournament golf a long time before that, so I was never able to use it in my tournament days.
Well, it's so interesting. I haven't asked that question for a long time, and I don't know why it came out now, but obviously it was for the right reason. That was an amazing piece of advice, and I really appreciate you sharing it with us.
Well, I've enjoyed it tremendously.
Thank you. And again, Mel Soul of Ritson, RITSON-SOLE.com or MelSoul.com. Thanks so much for coming on to the Golf Smarter podcast. I really enjoyed having this conversation today.
Good. I have certainly too, and I hope that you invite me again someday.
You're on, dude.
Okay.
Next up, we're going to address the impact that government cutbacks are having on high-profile municipal courses. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.